Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Greetings and welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. Okay, anyone who knows my writing and or listens to this podcast and or follows my Substack page, the motto of which is Make Western Civilization Great Again, knows that preserving Western civilization is a central professional concern and a humble mission of mine, and one of the most crucial arenas in which the West is under threat in this decadent era of ours is education. Certainly from as far back as the early 1980s, when Jesse Jackson led Stanford University students in a chant of, hey ho, Western Civ has got to go. But actually, even earlier than that, the subversive mission of the cultural Marxists has been to infiltrate teaching and administrative positions within higher education and to subvert the transmission of what the poet Matthew Arnold called the best which has been thought and said, the grand legacy of Western achievement. The reason is that passing that legacy down to the next generation is a roadblock to the progressive left's aims, which are the installation of groupthink in the next generation and the dismantling of the Christian capitalist West. The left has been alarmingly successful in achieving those aims over the last few decades, and a big part of the reason for that is that not only in higher education, but now beginning as early as grade school, progressive educators have been indoctrinating students with the perspective that Western civilization has been a uniquely evil force in world history. Oppressive, exploitative, and white supremacist, of course. It's hard to find a Western civilization textbook in modern times that does not, to one extent or another, reflect this subversive perspective. And that has done immeasurable damage to the culture, to society, to our young people. A self-loathing civilization is a doomed civilization. Well, I'm happy to say that I have in my hands, even as I record this podcast, volume one of a magnificent two-volume work called The Golden Thread, A History of the Western Tradition. This textbook intentionally rejects that propaganda and reclaims a properly balanced view that does not whitewash the history of the West, but fairly celebrates its triumphs and its role as an overall force for good in human history. And I hate to even call it a textbook, which may have negative connotations for many people. The word textbook suggests that it's dry and boring and scholarly in an off-putting way. This is not that. And I won't lie, it's not cheap, but it's an incredibly beautiful and valuable resource. In fact, I would say it is an invaluable resource for teaching your children or grandchildren or yourself about the highlights and lowlights, the glories and the travesties, the whole magnificent sweep of Western civilization in a way that you will not get from public schools or even most private schools. And to dive more deeply into it, I've done two things. One is review it for Front Page Mag. So keep your eyes out for that. And two is I have the author with us today to talk about the book and about the way our young people have been taught to despise their own cultural legacy, how we got to this point, and how we can, as I said, reclaim a view of our own past and present that enables us to flourish once again as the greatest civilization in human history. That's right, I said it, changed my mind. So stay tuned, you don't want to miss this conversation. And don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you don't already, so that you don't miss any of the compelling conversations we are having here. Don't touch that dial. Guest today at the intersection of politics and culture has been professor of history at Harvard for 40 years. He's earned too many academic awards to list, but among them is a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Renaissance Society of America. His writing has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the New Criterion, the Claremont Review of Books, and many other outlets. He's the co-author, most recently, of the new epic two-volume work called The Golden Thread, A History of the Western Tradition. He wrote Volume 1, which spans from the ancient Western world of Rome and Greece through the medieval world, which he rightly calls Christendom. We don't call it that anymore, tragically. And that traditional phrasing is one of the reasons I'm so supportive of this incredible achievement. James Hankins, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Professor, let me first congratulate you and your writing partner, Alan Gelzo, whom I hope to also have on a separate episode to talk about his volume two. Congratulations on this beautiful book. It's a work of art in itself. I confess I have a kind of a book fetish as well as an obsession with all things medieval. So this volume is going to occupy a special shelf of honor in my home, not as some kind of untouchable relic that's behind protective glass, but as a resource that I could go to again and again as a homeschooling father of five, and that I could even hand down to my kids for their children. I would say to any homeschooling parent out there, or any parent who cares about their child's or grandchild's education, to get this amazing work of history. I won't go on raving about it right now because I will rave about it further in more detail in a review I'm working on, but let me just begin by asking you, why did you and Professor Gelzo write this new history? There have been so many other histories of Western civilization down through the decades. I'm familiar with some of them. Why did you think a new one was needed?
Well, we are trying to revive the study of Western civilization, Alan and I, and we're both heading off to the Hamilton School of Classical and Civic Education at the University of Florida, where that's going to be our main mission, is reviving the study of Western Civ. Because as you rightly say, there are lots of books out there, most of them written a long time ago. Mm-hmm. The actual teaching of Western Civ has not been done very much in the last 40 years. We can talk about this, but there was a movement in the 80s and the 90s, successful movement, to get rid of Western Civ from K-12 education and also from universities. There are very few universities that still require it. And K-12 is completely gone. The state departments of education have successfully abolished it. It's mostly been replaced by world history, global history, that sort of thing, or by nothing at all, which is also a characteristic of our educational system at the moment. We don't like history, not me personally, obviously, but Americans have decided that they're not interested in the past. And I think that's wrong. I think actually the Americans are very interested in the past, but their teachers are not so much so. So Alan and I are trying to reestablish the study of Western Civ. And we need a book that addresses the crisis that we have at the moment in our civilization. Most of these books that are on the market still today were written 40, 50 years ago. They've been updated, new editions, but basically they're written for the Cold War period. And the challenges we have today are very different. And they're much more, let's say, internal to our culture. There's many more people trying to denigrate the Western tradition, not just American history, but the whole tradition of the West, from the Greeks and the Romans through the Middle Ages up until modern times. There are people, you know, as you know, I'm sure this is a theme of your podcast, that people want to denigrate the whole of the Western tradition and brand it as, you know, racist, sexist, colonialist, you name it. So that's part of what we're doing, is to try to answer some of these charges that are in the air by telling a fair story, telling a balanced story, the story that talks about our achievements as a civilization, but also about the failures. We're not overemphasizing the failures the way that is often done yeah. in current education. We're acknowledging the failures, but we're trying to lift up the wonderful examples of cultural achievements in the West. And these are in the arts and in music and literature, but they're also in political theory and political practice and traditions of freedom of religion, and all sorts of things that we should be proud of in the West. So that's really why we wrote the book.
Yes. I had the scholar Stanley Kurtz on the podcast recently, and we were talking about the infamous incident back in the mid-80s when Jesse Jackson led Stanford students in a chant of, "Hey ho, hey ho, Western Civ has got to go." Stanley marked that as a kind of a watershed moment when things begin to go south in higher education and in the culture in terms of presenting the West, as you noted, as a civilization to be ashamed of rather than celebrated. Does that sound about right to you? And also, you talked about the historical ignorance that many of us in the West have. What are the ramifications of that ignorance?
All right. Well, two questions, I guess.
Yes.
I agree with Stanley about that. In fact, I used his book about the he wrote a book on the decline of Western civilization, yeah, which I studied with Prophet. I think it's not just the negativity, right? We have the Vietnam generation that thought that Western civilization was equivalent to militarism. They even told a false history that Western civ was only invented in the 20th century as a justification of Western militarism. This is the kind of thing that people in the Vietnam generation were sensitive to.
Yeah.
So there was that. There was a negative attitude towards the West coming out of the Vietnam War. But the thing that people forget is the interest in globalization was coming out of the Hai administration at that time. At Harvard, we had a president who was determined to globalize Harvard. So that meant we studied, the emphasis switched from Europe and America to other parts of the world. That had been going on for a long time, and it's perfectly justified. I'm all in favor of studying other parts of the world. But it also decentered, as they say, the West. And furthermore, there was an idea that the Western civilization was somehow too parochial for the globalized university. And they were bringing in lots of foreign students. The students who attend Harvard now are, there's a very large proportion, I don't know the exact number, but I think it's over 30%, or maybe I'm wrong about that, but it's somewhere, it's a very high percentage of students attending Harvard and other elite universities who are not American. They're from abroad. And nothing wrong with that, but it does change the balance of interest among the students. And a third aspect, which I always raise, but people don't pay attention to, is the triumph of choice, the idea of choice, right? So we are officially a multicultural institution, and we are very, very expensive. And the cost of college has gone up dramatically, as you know, in the last 40 years. So students are now paying top dollar, or their parents are, and they don't want to be told what to do by the university or its professors. They have this consumerist attitude towards education. So they, if we tell them you must study this, they will say, I don't want to study that, I'll study something else. And the university does not have the conviction to say, these are the things you should know to be an educated person,
yeah,
right? So now we have the smorgasbord, we have the buffet, and you can study anything you want, and nothing is privileged above anything else. There's this very curious idea that, you know, all civilizations are created equal, and all cultures are created equal, so we can't favor one over the other, even if it happens to be our culture and our civilization, which I strongly disagree with. Yeah. So your other question was what the effect on modern students is of this sort of globalization. Well, you know, it's very sad. I think most students nowadays don't really consider themselves as Westerners. And they're kind of ashamed to be Westerners, or at least if they've imbibed this anti-Western bias of their teachers, they are ashamed of it. They think of themselves as cosmopolitan.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also just the sheer ignorance. You know, the students, I have very brilliant students. They're the best in the country, according to the university, and they know things, but they don't all know the same thing, right? You can't count on them knowing anything. So you find you're trying to teach a course on, let's say, the Middle Ages, and people will raise their hand and say, Professor Hankins, what's the Trinity, right? Okay, so children raised in a Christian society 40 years ago wouldn't ask that question.
Right.
Or they'll raise their hand and say, so, professor, which comes first, the Enlightenment or the Middle Ages?
Oh.
What?
And yeah.
So you're sometimes faced with total ignorance. And often these are students from abroad, who, you know, Chinese students who come to America, they've not had very much history outside Chinese history, And I don't blame them for being ignorant. I blame the university and K-12 education for not teaching people the things they should know. They should know what the Reformation is. They should know what the French Revolution is. They should know where we get science from. They should know the history of democracy and republics and all of that, because we use these terms constantly, but they really don't know what they mean. They don't know where the rule of law comes from, right? Some people think, oh, this is a Christian doctrine. We can't teach it because it's separation of church and state, blah, blah, blah. Rule of law, the idea that, you know, natural law comes from God, well, that's not something we can teach because we're secularists. But in fact, natural law comes from Stoic philosophy, and it doesn't come from Christianity at all. The Christians picked it up in the first century AD from the Stoics. It's in Cicero. And it's a philosophical idea and should be taught as part of the Western tradition. But people say, oh, no, we can't teach natural law because it's a religious doctrine. It's false, just false.
Yes. What is the Western tradition anyway? The Western tradition you mentioned in the title of the book, and what makes it so unique? Why is the West the best, as the saying goes?
Well, I'm not sure it's a fair comparison to say that the West is better than Imperial Chinese civilization, for example. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that, and this is something Alan and I both insist on in the book, is that the Western tradition is actually a third or fourth order civilization. So we have the Greeks. Greeks had their own civilization, and at a certain point, 2nd century BC, most people would date it at, the Romans conquered the Greeks, but they were wise enough to say, we need Greek civilization. So they started to imitate the Greeks in Latin, but they also absorbed Greek civilization. Many conquerors just want to destroy the world that they conquered, but the Romans were wise enough not to do that. So then you have Greco-Roman civilization. And then in the 4th century, the Roman Empire becomes Christian. So there flows into the Roman Empire the tradition of Jewish and Christian antiquity. And it becomes ultimately the official religion of the Roman Empire by the end of the 4th century. So then you have what I call in the book a confessional state. And this is a feature of the medieval centuries, not just in the West, but also in Islam. The idea there is that the state can only have one religion, and the purpose of religion, or one purpose of religion, is to uphold the authority of the state. So that situation lasts down to the 17th century. But in the 11th and 12th century, we get a new civilization arising, Western Europe civilization, the Latin-speaking civilization. Byzantium, the Eastern Roman Empire, declines. And the torch is carried forward by the Western Europeans, who found a new civilization, and it's built on Greece and Rome. It's also built on a certain level of Germanic customs, because Western Europe had been conquered by barbarians in the 5th century AD, and many barbarian customs, some of which are quite salutary for later history, enter into the bloodstream. So we're not really a single civilization.
Yeah.
We are several civilizations that are succeed each other and absorb the fruits of the earlier civilization. This is not, what's unusual about this, I think, is it's not a foregone conclusion that earlier civilizations will be preserved by later ones. We have the example of Islam, for example, which completely suppressed ancient Persian literature. Yeah. We have medieval and modern Persian literature, but everything before the Islamic conquest was essentially destroyed. The West didn't do that. And you have other civilizations like the Great Khmer Empire, the medieval period, the Cambodian Empire, which had an area at one time almost equal to the Roman Empire. And that civilization completely disappeared. Well, we don't have any writing from it. We have some inscriptions, but we only know about it because of some travelers from India and also Chinese historians, but they did not preserve their own history. So we have these magnificent monuments in Cambodia, which survived from their civilization, but they're ruins. It's just ruins.
Yeah.
So we're lucky, and we had a period when the Roman Empire was reduced to ruin, but the tradition carried on in literature. I can give you a great example of that, which I've been using to illustrate the idea of a tradition. So the Roman Republic, as you know, dies out in the time of Augustus, by the end of the first century, there is no Roman Republic in the sense of shared rule between the plebeians and patricians, or between the noble classes and the populist classes. Those ideas of shared power had disappeared, and there was no republic at all. Mm-hmm. They had a monarchy. So fast forward 1,000 years, yes. Okay? It's monarchy, monarchy, monarchy. Nothing but monarchy in Roman Empire until the 12th century. And then in the 12th century, you had some cities in north-central Italy that had become very wealthy, and they had declared their independence of the Holy Roman Empire. And so suddenly we have republics reappearing, and they have two consuls, and they have a senate, and they have an assembly, and they have magistrates, and it looks just like the Roman Republic, except that there hadn't been a Roman Republic for 1,000 years. So how did they know about this? Well, they knew about it through the Golden Thread. They knew about it through reading Livy, reading Sallust, the Roman law codes that survived. They were able to reconstruct what a republic was because of the literary tradition and legal tradition, and also, I think, and philosophical tradition. So they were able to bring those together and refound the idea of self-government in Europe after 1,000 years. So that's what we think is so important to remember for students today, because we're faced with a situation where people are trying to kill our culture, kill Western civ, shameful but true, and we need to remember that renaissances are possible. It's not just decline and fall. It's not just the Thucydides trap, which is such a popular idea in China, that rising power, falling power. There's also powers that have renaissances, that have rebirths of their lost civilizations and cultures. And that's what we have to be emphasizing right now. And that's why we wrote the book.
Dive into something, just to pick one example from countless examples in the book of things that I found interesting. I just want to zero in on something here and ask you about it. The history of this book, your history, begins with the Battle of Marathon, the outcome of which you say determined the whole later history of the West. I thought this was very interesting perspective. Could you elaborate on that briefly?
Yes. Yeah, so the standard beginning point for Greek history would be with the Mycenaeans, who were inspired the Homeric epics. But I decided to start with Marathon because it's the 5th century BC, the Battle of Marathon is 490. It's the 5th century BC where the Greeks become very aware that they're different. They're not like the other civilizations of the ancient Near East. They become conscious of themselves, as we would say today, as Westerners. And if you read Herodotus, who tells us the history of the Persian Wars, that's the theme of his great book, is that the battle of the Persian Wars were a conflict between East and West, between the ancient civilizations of the Persians, well, Persian not that old, but they inherited the ancient civilizations of Mesopotamia and the Nile River Valley, and then the Greeks, who had a different type of civilization. They had city-states, self-governing city-states. They had citizenship. They had a civilization that's built on trade as well as agriculture. They had a different political system. And the Greeks were very conscious of this by the 5th century BC, that they were different. So the Battle of Marathon is, in one way, the beginning of Western civilization, just because it's the point where the Greeks fully aware of what's at stake in these battles. Okay, mm-hmm. So there have been conflicts between the Persians and the Greeks before, but now they understood that everything was at stake. Right. So if they had lost this battle, and the other thing I point out in the book, there are great maps for this, by the way.
Yes.
is that Persia is a gigantic empire that stretches from the Hindu Kush down to Egypt and across into Asia Minor, and it's trying to conquer Greece. Greece is the next bit of real estate that they want to annex. And for them, the Persians think this is going to be easy. They have a pretty large army. They had bigger armies later on, but in the Battle of Marathon, they had an army that was many times the size of the Greek army. Mm-hmm. So they were just going to gobble up Greece and be done with it. I like the map in a way because it looks like the image of Persia is like a gigantic jaw, and the image of Greece is like something about to be eaten by the jaw.
Yes.
But you can check that out for yourself. But in any case, the battle was actually, I think, did decide later history, because if they'd lost that battle, they would have had to give in. The Persians had already conquered most of the cities of Asia, Greek cities on the coast of Asia Minor, and no one expected them to lose. But the Greeks discovered from this battle that they could beat Persians. They could beat large numbers of Persians, that their battle techniques, their battle weaponry was better than anything the Persians had, that their tactics were better. And that began the period of Greek military dominance over Persia, which ultimately ends with the conquests of Alexander the Great.
Yes.
Right. So it is a real turning point in history.
Yes.
And as I say in the book, if the Persians had won, the rest of the Mediterranean might have been Persian.
Yeah.
Might have been a Persian civilization. And instead, we have a civilization that is still today very much infused with Greek values, self-government, debate, reasoning, making arguments for things, having a popular approval of actions. This is something completely unknown in the Persian world, and in the Egyptian world, for that matter. And it all might have disappeared if the Persians had won. And instead, it became the foundations of a great, even greater set of civilizations in the West, the Greeks, the Romans, the medieval Christendom, and modern Europe.
Yes. Well, speaking of Christendom, let me jump all the way to the end of the book now, from the very beginning of it all the way to the end. You close the book with a short section called Gratitude to Christendom. Can you elaborate on the debt we owe to Christendom? And along those lines, can you also talk a bit about why gratitude and humility are so critical to the continued flourishing of civilization? Because I think the greatest dangers we moderns have brought on ourselves stem from the hubris that you also talk about in this book.
Well, I agree entirely. And I'm emphasizing gratitude and humility in the face of past achievements, because there are virtues that are lacking in our own society. And it's a particular vice of modernism to think that the past is completely unusable. It's morally inferior to us.
Yes.
We owe it nothing. We in America are an innovative society. We're focused on the future. But the future does not have any heroes. The future doesn't have any villains. The future does not have any historical experience to draw upon. And if people need to study the past so they understand that what we have today is something that other people fought for and tried to preserve. There are people in the line of battle who are fighting for these things. There are monks sitting in monasteries copying the works of classical antiquity for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
All these people were devoted to keeping this great tradition alive. And it makes me angry, really. I shouldn't admit to that, but it does make me angry that people are so thoughtlessly throwing away all of these achievements.
Yes.
Because if they're not remembered, they're not able to be carried forward. Okay. So about Christendom, one of the things that I've emphasized, and here I'm kind of aligned with Tom Holland. I don't know if you've read Tom Holland.
Oh, yes. Dominion, among others.
Yes, the Dominion is what I'm actually thinking of.
Yeah.
Because Tom Holland recognizes that what we have today, our moral responses today, are a large extent conditioned by Christianity. The moral universe that we live in was created by Christians. And, the hostility to, let's say, the sexual exploitation of women as slaves is something that Christianity brought to the world. The Christians of the 4th century abolished, or tried to abolish, they took them a few decades to do it, but they abolished blood sports.
Yes.
They abolished gladiatorial games. They abolished massacring thousands and thousands of animals for the entertainment of people. They outlawed, eventually, by the 5th century, the use of slaves for sex without the sexual exploitation of male and female slaves.
Yes.
That got outlawed. And there is in the West the first, thanks to Christianity, the first recognition of human dignity, which you find in the Greek church father Gregory of Nyssa. He's the first person to emphasize the dignity of man, which is owing to two things. It's his rational nature, he gets that from Greek philosophy, and it's the fact that we are made in the image of God. That's Christian. Right, so that's human dignity. The seeds of the idea of human dignity, of equal dignity, come out of Christianity and Judaism. I would say also in Judaism as well. Mm-hmm. So I think that's something to be grateful for.
Yes.
And I think we should be grateful also that the Christian religion did not wipe out the culture of ancient Greece and Rome. As I mentioned before, the Islamic culture is much more radical in its attempt to destroy. The Islamic world really hated Rome. It was a military rival.
Mm-hmm.
They hated Persia less. And in fact, they became Persianized later in the Abbasid caliphate. But they destroyed a lot, and they're still destroying, in Hindu countries, they're destroying Hindu temples and
yes.
So forth. So we should be grateful that Christianity had a more expansive, accepting view of what of the value of ancient culture. There were people in the 4th century, there were radical Christians in the 4th century, who said, we have enough literature in the Bible. This is a rich book. We can use that as a base of education. Let's get rid of all the pagan literature. And there were some, but some Christians were wise. And you know, St. Augustine, St. Ambrose, St. Jerome, they said, no, we need the ancient achievements in grammar and rhetoric and the seven liberal arts. We need all those things to conduct our own civilization. So they obviously reoriented the educational system of antiquity. They oriented it to Christian ends, but they kept much of ancient culture, and that continued to be fruitful for the West, to have that interplay of the Christian and the classical, which goes on throughout the Middle Ages and in the Renaissance and early modern period. And that has only been, the interplay of the Christian and the classical as the basis for education has only really been stopped since the late 19th century.
Let me jump to another topic here, Professor. We've lived in a culture which for decades now has placed a premium value on what I call the now, the new, and the what's next. In America especially, we've always been a forward-looking nation. You noted in the introduction, or quoted someone in the introduction, saying that the only way to save modernity is to free it of militant modernism. How do we in the West find a balance between that imperative of innovation and the sort of tradition that you and I want to preserve?
Well, that's the key question. I'm getting this perspective from a French philosopher, French Catholic philosopher I like very much, named Remy Brog, who wrote a book which has been translated into English called Moderately Modern. We have to be moderately modern, meaning that we have to exercise moral and civilizational control over innovation. So we just can't, we have this situation now where we have tech lords who are pushing us into sort of transhumanist directions. They're trying to get complete control over our lives. There are many good things, obviously, in the innovations that Silicon Valley is doing. AI is a great example, but it also can be abused. So we need to have the counterweight of tradition to balance out modernity. And what I mean by counterweight is we need to have people who are formed in the Western tradition and who have values inherited from the Western tradition, which will give them a better sense of what is valuable and what is not valuable, what's dangerous, what's possibly tyrannous, right? One of the things that the Western tradition teaches democracy, self-rule, has two enemies. It has factionalism and it has tyranny. And of course, we have both going on in our society, and there is a remarkable lack of historical depth in discussing these issues. But I think that the dangers from the tech world are tyranny, right? That we become tyrannized by people who control the technology and who don't care about what they're doing to people. And they have their own idea about what type of human being they would like to be. And they want to create technology which will allow them to be that. But they shouldn't be forcing it down on the rest of us who may not want to have a brain implant,
yes,
a mind link, which is telling us, which is our external our drive, which is telling us what to think and how to act and how to consume. So I think that the tradition is very important for providing a moral framework and a sense of the past and the present, who we are as a people, in order to inform these would-be tyrants, or I shouldn't call them would-be tyrants. I don't think they want to be tyrants.
Yeah.
I think they want to have power, and many of them want power for good. But they have to know that tyranny always starts with
yes,
with good intentions, right?
Yes.
Emergency powers and good intentions. They want to make the world better, and then they end up tyrannizing the world.
Well, speaking of tradition, as someone who reads a lot of history, I really appreciate the unabashedly traditional perspective in this new work, The Golden Thread, which comes through even in what some people might consider small details, such as using the terminology B.C. and A.D. for before Christ and in the year of the Lord, rather than what has been the norm in academia over the last several decades, which is the more secular terminology B.C.E. for before the Common Era and C.E. for Common Era instead of A.D. So I appreciate that perspective and those details. I know this is beyond the scope of this volume one, but what is your take on the state of the West today? You've alluded to some things, some areas in which we might be in decline, such as our historical ignorance. Do you see other areas in which we are in a state of decline? And is that decline irrevocable? In other words, have we just had a good run, but all civilizations must come to an end?
No, I think there is always the possibility of renaissance and drawing inspiration from the past. I will say one thing about the current moment, which is perhaps might seem less important, but to me it's quite important, is the lack of civility and the loss of any sense that we have to deal with people who think differently from ourselves. One of the things that an education in Western civilization can do is give people a common history, give people a common set of reference points, so that they can discuss things. But also there's rules of civility. The Western tradition has the idea of chivalry, which is born in the 12th century, which merges with the ideal of the gentleman and the lady, of course, too, during the Renaissance. And it was an ideal for many centuries that there's a certain behavior that's expected of people who are leaders and who have, a position in society. They have to behave in a certain way. They have to
yes,
be civil. They have to treat each other politely. And I'm an old man now. I'm 70 years old. And I am very aware of how this has disappeared, even in institutions like the university. I shouldn't say it's disappeared, but it's certainly been weakened. There are many people in the university, mostly political activists, who aren't the least bit concerned for civility. And you also find it in the language that people use, much more violent, much more emotional, much filthier language. that people use on an everyday basis, and I deplore that. I think that people who aspire to leadership positions in our society should set a standard. And that was always understood, that teachers and professors and politicians and statesmen, corporate leaders even, should be setting an example. But we don't. I think that whole ideal has very much weakened and needs to be restored.
I agree completely. What can the average student or citizen do to preserve the Western tradition, the Western legacy? That sounds like a very grandiose and overwhelming responsibility, but surely there's something each of us can do to contribute to the defense and preservation of the Western tradition.
Well, I think the first thing is just to inform oneself about it. People are constantly attacking Western civilization with ignorant remarks about colonialism and sexism and racism. And if you actually know something about the West, you would understand that these are either not true, greatly exaggerated, or not any different from any other civilization. But it's the ignorance of our own past which allows these charges to stick.
Yes.
And I also think that in public schools and universities, the authorities there should try to reconstruct a common culture from the American past and from the Western past. It's great to study Chinese history. I love Chinese history. I read it all the time. It's great to study Islam, Hindu. I'm very interested in world history because it's so illuminating about the West. You get to see how different the West is.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, we have to have a common possession in our own history. So I think that there should be some steps, and there already have been steps, of course, in many states to restore the study of Western civilization. That's a big theme of the DeSantis administration in Florida, which is one reason I'm going to the Hamilton School there, because I am very happy to see the state government there say, we need to learn Western history. We need to learn Jewish history. That's part of the remit, too, of Hamilton Center. I don't think you would find huge numbers of university students siding automatically with Muslims against Jews, as we saw in the last couple of years, if people had been more deeply grounded in the Western tradition and realized the differences between those two civilizations and I shouldn't call them civilization, but, Islam is a civilization. Judaism is a religious tradition.
Mm-hmm.
But if people understood better what the ideals and practices and laws of both of those civilizations were, I think that they would be more likely to sympathize with the Jewish state and less so with the attacker, the people who attacked the Jewish state on October 7th.
I just want to say again that this book, The Golden Thread, and so far I've seen only Volume 1, but I'm sure Volume 2 is just as spectacular. It's just an amazing work. It's going to be a tough act to follow. Are you, and you deserve a breather, but have you already thought about what you may be working on next?
Well, we're working on a number of projects to make The Golden Thread more accessible and easy for teachers to teach, because it's not a small thing to ask people to give up their lesson plans and their current textbooks and to take on a new one, especially a big one like ours.
Yes.
So that's part of what we're doing. Yeah, I'm running lots of things, too many things.
Yeah.
I've been writing on virtue in Western tradition, so I'm going to write a book about the application of virtue theory to foreign policy. But that's we can't get into that one, believe me, because that'll really be a mare's nest. And I'm not really far enough along with that. But I have many interesting things I'm writing about.
Yeah, interesting. Well, how can people keep up with what you are doing? Do you have an online presence?
I have a website, jameshankins.org, and that's got all of my public-facing work on it, and it has links to the more scholarly work that I did for most of my academic career. And there's also information there about where I'm going to be lecturing and presentations and so forth I'm giving. So if people want to come or tune in or to even come see me lecturing, they can do that too.
Excellent. Good to know. Listeners, I strongly encourage you to get The Golden Thread. It is an investment in your education, your children's, your grandchildren's education, and in preserving the legacy of the West. James Hankins, thanks for writing it, and thanks for joining us at The Right Take.
Well, it's been a great pleasure, and I've enjoyed the discussion immensely.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already. And if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you.